Music from Keith and Kristen Getty, Oh, For a Closer Walk with God. And it's 10 minutes after the hour. It's a Tuesday morning, and we're joined by Dr. Don Clark, who is a vigneron and vintner, also a biochemist, which probably comes in handy in his grape-growing activities, and also a member of the board at Creation Moments. And he joins us every Tuesday morning, and we talk about matters of science and faith. And Dr. Don, down there in Garden Valley, Texas, how are things?
Well, there it was cold when I left.
Now, what is cold? I have to ask you, what is cold?
Oh, it's 50-ish.
This man does not know cold.
And actually, it was in 30. It was in the upper 30s in the morning when I left for grape camp.
Do you expect sympathy from us?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, okay. I mean, I had to get my scraper out to scrape my windshield.
Oh, no. Oh,
no.
On Saturday morning, yes, it is true.
No. Well, there are so few times that we can claim moral superiority in something as diaphanous as the weather.
Yeah.
But this would be that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's probably in the 60s right now, but going up, we're going to have a rainy day, maybe a rainy couple of days. So it has gotten warmer again.
Mm-hmm.
And our winter has not yet come. Mm. So our vines are still green.
Yeah, okay. Is that good? Does that mean anything, or is it just a fact of life?
Well, I still have some things to do after going to grape camp. I need to spray the vines with some boron and put down some phosphate. Okay. But so I've got some things before they go completely dormant that needs to get absorbed into the trunk and into the tissue.
Still work to do to prepare for winter then.
Okay. Yep. Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, it's a good thing that the vines are still green.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if they happen to have a growing spurt right before they freeze, that's not a good thing.
No, I wouldn't think so. Wouldn't think so. Well, listen, we've got a hot topic for you today. This is an article that David ran across. It's actually a blog site for National Public Radio, NPR, and it's a blog from Marcelo Gleiser. And the title of it is, it's a question, can scientific belief go too far? And I want to read just a sentence from the opening paragraph here. It says, do some scientists hold on to a belief longer than they should? Or, more provocatively phrased, when does a scientific belief become an article of faith? Now, we've talked about this, or talked around this many times in the past. What's the difference between science and faith, Don?
Oh, well, the classical science was, you know, you observe something and then you're trying to you observe something in nature and then you try to, describe it either with mathematical formulas typically and then be able to predict a related behavior based on your mathematical formula or theories. Or conjecture, and if it should happen to come true, then maybe your theory about the way this particular observation in nature behaves might actually be true. If it doesn't, then you look for other explanations.
Well, how does science designate a truth? Does it say this is a law of thermodynamics, or a law of hydraulics, or a law of physics? Does the status of law confer the official scientific approval as a thought or an idea or a phenomenon as truth?
Well, you establish it through history and through testing and testing and more testing. So, the first step in the scientific process is that you have a hypothesis or you have a guess. So, yes, scientists do guess. And then from that guess, you say, well, either my guess is right or either it's wrong. And normally you would take the null hypothesis, which would say, my guess is wrong, and so therefore if I do this experiment, it won't work out.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do the experiment and it does work out, then your guess is right. And then if you do it repeatedly enough, then the hypothesis becomes a theory. And other people have reproduced your experiment and said, yeah, it looks like it holds there, and it looks like it holds over here, and you said it would probably hold over there, and yes, it does, so it looks like you got a theory. And then if you repeat the experiment, more and more, eventually, if it is a fundamental principle, then everybody who repeats the experiment says, yeah, this works. Whenever I throw a ball up, it comes down, and it comes down at this speed. So if I know, how high I throw my ball, I know how much energy I need to put into the system to throw it up that high, and then I know how fast it's going to be coming down when it finally hits the ground. Mm-hmm. So you have the law of gravity, for example. So that's the difference in those three areas. You start with a guess, and eventually it might become a law if it's a fundamental principle.
Yeah, howsoever, and you mentioned that you used the term classic science, and in my mind at least, that takes me back 100, 150, 200 years when we were first really discovering things in nature and putting two and two together and developing these hypotheses and then the theories and then deciding on what we would call laws and actually principles about how the Earth works. And as the article says here, and they don't fault science, penicillin does cure diseases, airplanes do fly, Halley's Comet does come back every 76 years. There are certain things that have proved correct that develop out of science. But there was a time in the early 20th century when a lot of that classic science had to be thrown out the window. And it came with the, I don't know whether to call it a discovery or an invention, or at least maybe the perception of quantum mechanics, things that are really tiny. It seems like what science had concluded about matter in general had to be revised. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, it is, because the classic science, like, for example, Isaac Newton and the classic physics, you could describe pretty accurately, I mean very accurately, certain laws like gravity, for example, with relatively simple equations. And then you went into something like electromagnetism, and then you had Michael Faraday and James Maxwell, for example, who also described those with a little bit more math thrown in. But they could describe magnetic fields and electromagnetic properties. Maxwell, for example, his equation ties. The reason why it's called electromagnetic is because electricity and magnetism are inherently tied together. So he kind of unified electricity and magnetism and is given credit for that. But when you get down to the atomic level, you got some strange things going on that physicists kind of scratched their heads initially, and actually scratched their heads for a long time. Because you got into this area called quantization, and things didn't move smoothly. For example, we've known this from spectrophotometry, for example, now for quite some time, because when you excite an electron, for example, it just doesn't move smoothly from one energy state to another. It actually jumps. So you put in enough energy, and then it'll actually jump into a different orbit or orbital. They had to throw into the picture that, wow, things aren't smooth there. And when you get down to the tiny realm, they're actually quantized. And so that's where their name, quantum physics, came from. But then another strange thing happened was in classical Newtonian physics, for example, you can know a moving body's direction, and you can know its speed, for example. So you know where it's going, and so you can predict where it'll be, a second from now, or if you want, hours from now, mm-hmm. if it stayed in motion. But you can't do that in quantum in the realm of the atom, because there was a fellow called Heisenberg, and he came up with the uncertainty principle that said you cannot know both the position and direction of an object at the same time. Either you know the direction or you know the position, but you can't know them both. And so things were fuzzy. They weren't as well behaved as what we see on the macro scale. So on the micro scale or the nano scale, or the atomic scale, things are really very bizarre and very strange.
And so it's one of the things that I remember about quantum physics is that there seemed to be a particle that would only move or appear when you were looking for it. That there seemed to be something that was almost undemonstrable or unprovable. That particles would appear only when you were looking in that direction. Or in some cases, when you were not looking there.
Yeah. Well, even light, for example. Light, if you don't look at light, it has a wave property. So it looks like a wave. If you look at it, or if you try to do an experiment, it actually has a particle characteristic. It's almost like space has collapsed, by trying to observe it. So those, that's some strange stuff. And then you've got in the quantum subatomic realm, they've now discovered that some of these particles, as they smash photons, for example, together in these high energy photon cyclotrons, smash particles together and look for the subatomic particles and the paths where they go. They see a subatomic particle, for example, disappear and then reappear a short distance away. It's like, it's leaving our space and going someplace else and then reappearing here. And so based on, those experiments, they say, we've got more than, let's say, the four dimensions, the length, width, and height, and time. Einstein threw in time to the equation, and he showed that time was actually a physical property. We've got more dimensions than those. And so eventually, by doing those type of experiments, they figured, there must be 10 dimensions to space. And that's hard for us to get our hands around because, two dimensions we can understand, three dimensions we can understand. Maybe we can stretch it to four, but how do you stretch it to 10? So it's something that we don't observe on the macro level, from the physical properties and some of these results of these experiments, it appears that it actually, there is actually more than four dimensions of space.
Well, is it correct? Is it accurate then to say there are two realms of science? There's classic and there's quantum mechanics. What's the border between them like? And then I want to get this discussion too into the connection with faith. But is there a border between, should I say, standard science and quantum mechanics? And how small does small have to be before it becomes quantized?
Yeah, you got to be at the level of of the atom. It appears to see these strange behaviors.
So
reappearing.
There's a sudden point where science changes then, and it's at the side. It's subatomic.
Well, yeah, it appears. Mm-hmm. It appears at that. Now you can take the equations that have been derived for some of these quantum physics equations that work at the atomic level, and when you scale them up, they reduce down to the classical physics. Which is, it's at least satisfying that that indeed, happens at the macro scale. Because if it didn't happen at the macro scale, you'd kind of wonder, is your micro is your microsystem even close to being able to predict things?
Mm-hmm.
They can, you know, they've found that, and there is some satisfaction there. But when you start, the problem here is that you, out of this type of physics, for example, it's mathematical. And you have to come up with some type of, you have to envision, some type of, properties of space itself, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Einstein had to envision that, space is something, there is a substance to space. And because of his thought experiments, really, that there was a substance to space, he came up with the general theory of relativity and came up with the idea that time is indeed a property of space, and that massive bodies curve space, and that has to do with the property of gravity, and gravity is the more space is curved, the greater gravity you have, so there's a direct there's a relationship between how much space is curved and the gravity of an object.
Now, of course, Einstein and other physicists, Niels Bohr and some others in the early part of the 20th century were instrumental in ushering in the atomic age. They must have been on the edge between the classic science and quantum mechanics. They're the people that pushed us across to seeing what the world of quantum mechanics was like. But there are still some beliefs, some holdover beliefs from classic science that have rooted so deeply that we have trouble dealing with them as anything other than pure fact now. And there's a line in this blog I want to read to you. And it says, when there is a persistent holding on to a belief that is continually contradicted by facts, then that belief can only be called faith. In the quantum case, it's faith in an ordered rational nature, even if it reveals itself through random behavior. God doesn't play dice, wrote Einstein to his colleague Max Born. So those people, Einstein in particular here, was dealing with that kind of murky intermediate ground between fact and faith. What examples today exist of science that has become faith, would you say?
Well, it's these models that they've come up with for the subatomic particles, for example. And Einstein himself, Niels Bohr says, look, this, when you get down to this level, it's statistical. We can't know exactly where the electron is, and that's what Heisenberg.
So we don't have tools to see. We can't feel. We have no sensors. So it boils down to mathematics.
Yeah, it boils down to mathematics, and it's fuzzy math. It's not even Isaac Newton did not have fuzzy math. I mean, mm-hmm. he said you throw a ball with so much force and gravity's acting on it, it's going to have this type of curvature. We're not talking about that anymore. We're talking about having to deal with statistical mechanics in the physics realm, where you can't really say exactly that, this particle is going to be here at this time. All you can give it is this fuzzy shell of, electrons, for example, even around, the nucleus.
So we're talking probabilities then.
Yeah, you're into probabilities. It's mm-hmm. it's almost like your weatherman saying there's a 50% chance of rain today, and you're saying, why can't you tell me whether or not it's going to rain? Mm-hmm. And he'll say, well, there's a 50% chance.
Mm-hmm. Right, but I am.
Gotcha.
But I am telling you.
I am telling you that you have a 50% chance that it's going to rain on you today. And it's kind of the same way in the quantum, field, that we can say, well, there's a 50% chance that this electron's going to be here, but it may not.
Mm-hmm.
And it even, so when you start, and so they come up with these models for subatomic particles, and they came up with a supersymmetry, type of model that says for every this type of particle, there's got to be a counterparticle to it. And some of those we've found, but many of them we haven't. but it's just the belief that those particles should be there because we like symmetry, and things need to be, you know, in order. And I would, you know, if I were doing it, I'd probably say the same thing, because God is a God of order. He's not a God of disorder. And that's what Einstein was basing his comment on. And so when you get into these realms where you know, you're probing the edge of the universe, if you will, on a micro scale, because it's on the sub atom, you know, scale. You're taking guesses as to, you know, what this world is like. And many of the guesses are just pure mathematical and just pure. I believe it's got to be symmetrical. I believe that, you know, for every particle of matter, there's got to be an antimatter, particle associated with it. And so then you wind up doubling the amount of matter in space. Well, you know, is that true or is it not? They haven't found all the antimatter that's supposed to be there.
Well, it seems then that quantum mechanics is producing conclusions and findings that, much to the irritation of science, are not testable.
Well, they're not testable because they'll come up with a theory and says, well, it's going to take this much energy in order to find this particle, for example. And so they build these big colliders, and they want more and more money to build higher and higher energy, colliders, so we can move these things faster and we can smash them together harder so that we can test whether or not those particles exist. Well, you have kind of run out,
I think we lost Don momentarily. There he is. Okay. Are you back, Don?
Hello? Whoops. Yep. I lost you.
Yeah, we did. I think you're back, though.
I'm back? Okay. Yeah. So we're kind of at the edge of our capabilities for smashing these things together, which means that there's a lot of particles left that in their symmetry model that can't be found because we can't. Hello?
Yep, still here.
Okay, we can't, get high enough energy in order to find them. Mm-hmm. So at that point, you believe that they're there, so you're in the faith realm, but you can't test for it. Mm-hmm. And science was all about testing your hypothesis. Well, you can't test your hypothesis.
And so, what can you conclude? Is it you have to publish best guesses?
Well, and you come up with, you know, you come up with your model, and you say, this is, this at least mathematically helps to describe what we do see. Mm-hmm. And so maybe these things do exist after all.
And then the question arises, if classic science can progress to the point of applied science, that is, they take the rules and the laws and the principles that they've discovered and make product using that, tools and technology and so forth that behaves predictably, things that can be manufactured and used. Does it mean that nanotechnology will never get to that point?
Well, atomic technology, enough was discovered to, for example, to understand the principles of building an atomic bomb. To use atomic energy, at least in a crude way, for generating electricity and some other things. Building an airplane is classical physics. Mm-hmm. And engineering. Those principles are well understood. So, you know, that's not the problem. You don't have to worry about your building, you know, collapsing if you've done the engineering properly. That has been, you move from the area of kind of discovery physics, for example, into an engineering realm when you've put your principles into practice so much that it's now a mathematical exercise. For calculating, you know, the structural stresses, for example, in a building or in a bridge, that the physics for that was discovered, mm-hmm. you know, years and years ago. But to be able to use some of the physics that is being discovered now, for example, we haven't gotten there.
Yeah, I'm wondering if this isn't the case for the old statement, what you don't know can't hurt you. There are a lot of unknowns out there, and still we get up every day, we go about our business, society goes on, life day after day, in predictable fashion. So despite the unpredictability at that subatomic level, things seem to be held together somehow, don't they?
Well, and they do, and the Bible does speak to this. You know, it's held together, I mean, you know, by God's hand, obviously, and if he removes his hand, then things kind of break apart, and they will. You know, at the end of this age, we know that, you know, space, for example, will be ripped apart. You know, what does that mean? I mean, we can't even fathom that. But we do know, at least, that there is something to space, and that, you know, God spoke into space, and if it was God's voice, his very voice that, for example, caused a disturbance in this structure of space that created light in the first place, and all of these subatomic particles and atomic particles are based on, you know, of course, they're high energy light, but they're based on this this disturbance in space that God spoke in the very beginning, which is kind of the outline from Genesis 1 that we get. Then you move out of the realm of science. You use some historical information in the Bible, and you try to mesh the both together, and maybe you can come out with maybe a better picture of doing that, of what actually is going on, than you know, just trying to ignore scripture, you know, completely. And so, anyway, yeah, things are very strange in this realm. And there was, I think I've spoke of it here on this program once before, but one of the classic principles is that the speed of light is constant. Well, it's constant in a vacuum. It's not constant if light is moving through glass, for example. That's where we get the refractive index. But it's constant, let's say, in a vacuum. There's no such thing, but it's constant. It looks like it's constant in space. But when you get down to these the quantum levels, space itself is not constant. It's quantized. And so if space is more compressed, which it appears to be, near mass or near heavy objects or even objects in then and if space is quantized, then you would expect around mass, for example, that light would actually appear to slow down, even though when we measure it, it's got the same speed. Then in the middle of space, where there's no galaxies or, you know, anything else going on, that light would move very fast. But again, if you moved out in that space, you wouldn't be able to tell, because the distance, let's say, for a fabric of space would be, you know, greater in the open space than it would be near a massive object. You know, it's.
Well, I'm sure glad David understands this stuff. Yeah.
What's that?
I'm sure glad David understands this stuff now.
Yeah. All right.
So you try to envision what you.
But physics isn't addressing this, mm-hmm. you know, at all. And you know, as a creationist, and as a if I was in, you know, quantum physics, for example, I would look at this. You know, I would look at that property and say, what can I predict if I assume, you know, what I just said?
Well, the thing is, if you go back and admit that the speed of light is not constant, then a lot of the old laws and theories and rules you have to throw out the window. And science is reluctant to let go of those things.
Well, and it,
you have to look at it from a different perspective. And, you know, ultimately it'll collapse like I said before, even quantum physics collapses into Newtonian physics in a macro scale. Mm-hmm. So all this needs to be tied together, but it may give you some hints as to is there a fabric to space? What is the fabric? How big are the distances in the fabric of space? You know, those type of things, which would be some interesting quantum physics for sure.
And even the question, is distance even relevant? Is it real? Because you've talked about subatomic particles that appear, disappear, and then reappear someplace else. So logic tells us it traveled the distance between point A and point B when it may not have.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, what is the fabric of space behind our space? Then you can get, if you look at it from a spiritual, realm, did that particle go through the second heaven, for example, where, Satan and his cronies live, his domain, the spiritual realm. And then you've got, of course, the third heaven where God lives, which is another discussion. But, how do you tie all that together? And is it even possible for us to even figure this out?
It's a good question. David, I kind of talked over you there. Did you have a thought you wanted to?
We've kind of gotten off to, one of the things that when I first read the article that struck me was, and all of the discussion about quantum physics and all the rest of this has been fascinating and very interesting. But the thing that grabbed me most was the notion that there are scientists who hang on to an idea or a principle or a thought or a theory, even after it's been disproven by everybody else. And the thing that jumped out at me, and I looked between the lines, and there I saw it, the word evolution. I kept seeing the same thing over and over again. Every other paragraph I'd read, who's got blind faith now? That's what tripped my trigger about this particular article. And the things that we keep talking about, we've referred to a number of times in the past. I mean, it seems like no matter how many times examples of evolution or supposed evolution are disproven, they're just kind of ignored, they're cast aside. They're just like, well, never mind, that didn't really apply. That's not really the whole thing. What is it about this theory of evolution? I'm not even sure if it's to the level of theory. Maybe it's to the level of principle. But it doesn't seem like it justifies the overwhelming faith that people have put into it.
Well, absolutely, you're correct. Mm-hmm. And I don't call it a theory. It's a guess. And there's no way of saying, the Earth started, the world started this way, the universe started this way, or it started this other way. There's no way of testing that. And so it's not testable, and there's no way of testing evolution, because you just if they're saying that you need billions of years for this to happen, or millions of years at least, we're not going to wait around for that experiment to actually take place.
Well, the basic flaw to me in evolution is let's say you've got two fossils. One that you've measured at 50,000 years old, and another that's measured at 10,000, and you see certain similarities in them. There's a spinal cord, and they're ribs. And so you're tempted to say, aha, one of these derived from the former. The newer came from the former. That, to me, is a huge assumption. I mean, how do you prove that?
Yeah, and it's a huge jump. And, things have gotten a little better, but because now evolution is described based on DNA in doing some DNA analysis between this species and that species, and saying, the DNA is similar, so therefore this organism, because it looks like it's more advanced than this other organism, must have evolved from this other organism. Mm-hmm.
Well, the question of designating more advanced is a qualifying comment that can't be substantiated either. I mean, what makes it advanced as opposed to regressed?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What does the And so you have to have preconceived notions of that concept that you superimpose on your observation that, some of these, there's a lot of DNA and therefore similar proteins in these two systems. And so you're looking at it from a bottom-up type of an approach instead of from a top-down that says, hey, of course, those you've got similar proteins in similar DNA in these organisms because they were created by the same person, and it was if a thing works, why mess with it, type of thing. Now anyway, yeah, that's we can get off on that topic as well.
Well, I don't think that's getting off at all because it pertains to this article. We're talking about the tendency of science to cling tenaciously to ideas, precepts, conclusions that can't be tested or have, in some cases, been actually disproven. But there's so much at stake, as the author of the article says here. How should we deal with this kind of situation in science? Clearly, scientists will do what they want. Parenthetically, as long as they have funding for it. You know, those who cling to supersymmetry will argue that it will drive them toward other hypotheses, and that's okay. Maybe something will come up that will be testable. Others will search for explanations elsewhere. And to me, that's the key, searching for other explanations. That answer to evolution is, there are other explanations that serve equally as well, and design is one of them.
Right, exactly. And, you know, once you've stacked the information or you stack the evidence on one side or the other, you certainly wind up with most of the evidence pointing to design as opposed to evolution.
Well, it's a fascinating article, and we will include a link to this article, this blog over at npr.org, with our podcast with Dr. Don this morning. It'll be posted on the Broken Road site here in a couple of hours. And otherwise, it's a long search. I couldn't give you the link. You could search for maybe, can scientific belief go too far? That's the simple title of the article at npr.org. Otherwise, just wait for that that podcast, and we'll provide a link for you so that you can use that. Dr. Don, as always, it's been a delight. Thank you for joining us today. I want to encourage people to visit the Creation Moments website, creationmoments.com, because it's a place where you'll find science. But science that speaks to young earth creationism. And indeed, there is science, valid science, that supports that program. It's just science you don't get to hear very often, and science that routinely gets shouted down. So I want to encourage a visit to creationmoments.com, and if you do that, I think you'll be rewarded. You can link there from our website at brokenroadradio.com. Don, I hope you have a great week. I hope it warms up for you. I hate to think that you're just freezing down there at 50 degrees. I mean, heavens.
Oh, yeah, no. We're okay right now. I mean, it's nice. It's going to be in the 60s, maybe even get into the 70s. So, yes, it's... exactly.
Don, thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next Tuesday, okay?
Okay, sounds good.
See you, Don. Thanks, buddy.
All right, so long.